Rediscover God's Word, verse by verse, chapter by chapter. This is Real Bible Study with teacher Tom Bradford. Welcome to Torah Class.
Well, when we ran out of time in our previous lesson, we were still in Zechariah chapter 6 on the subject of the Tzemach, and variously translated as branch or shoot or sprout. And in both Judaism and Christianity, this Tzemach is identified as the Messiah. And in both Judaism and Christianity, this Tzemach is a real figure that is to appear in Zechariah's future, even still in our future. Now, it's clearly stated that the very first thing this branch will do is to build the temple. Notice how this remains within the pattern we have read in both Haggai and Zechariah. That is, God insisted that the first thing the returning exiles from Babylon were to do was to rebuild the temple. They disobeyed, and it cost them dearly. Now, Judaism sees this future temple as a literal physical temple, while Christianity is split on the issue, with some agreeing that this will be a real physical temple, the other faction insisting that it is a so-called spiritual temple. Now, the spiritual temple is what this group of Christians would call the church, and therefore it is more or less in existence right now. Now, there are some pastors who have adopted a sort of middle ground by saying that indeed there will be a physical temple constructed just after Yeshua returns, but that happens because the remaining Jews are still confused in their thinking. Now, a temple structure will be built, but what this verse is really talking about is the temple being believers themselves. Okay? Neither of these last two groups that I just described is able to seriously address the issue of the elaborate blueprints for the millennial temple that is contained in the final 8 chapters of Ezekiel. So I have no issue with just dismissing such notions as but man-made doctrines that just have no biblical basis. Let's reread the final 5 verses of Zechariah chapter 6. Open your Bibles to Zechariah chapter 6. We'll start reading at verse 11. Take silver and gold, make crowns. Put one on the head of Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the Kohen Hagadol, that's the high priest, and tell him, Adonai Sefaot says, there is coming a man whose name is Tzemach. He will sprout up from his place and rebuild the temple of Adonai. Yes, he will rebuild the temple of Adonai. He will take up royal splendor, sitting and ruling from his throne. There will be a Kohen, a priest, before his throne, and they will accept each other's advice in complete harmony. The other crowns will be for Helem, Toviah, Yeriah, and Chen, the son of Savaniah. Then they are to be kept as a memorial to the temple of Adonai. Those who are now far away will come and help rebuild the temple of Adonai. Then you will know that it is Adonai Sefaot who sent me to you, and it will all come about, provided you heed carefully what Adonai your God says. Now, by way of review, we see that a delegation of Jews has brought gold and silver to Jerusalem for the purpose of making crowns. And we notice that there's some disagreement in Bible versions over whether this word for crowns is singular or plural. The Hebrew is atarot, And the suffix, by the suffix, it's clearly plural. Those scholars that think it should be singular say it was a copyist error, or there was some heavy redaction that took place that actually reworked this passage to make it plural. There's no evidence for this claim. It's merely the speculation of some translators. Now, because there is no evidence to support these speculations, I have a little choice but to take it that more than one crown was to be manufactured from that silver and gold. And as we'll see, the context demands that it was two crowns. Yet the idea of silver and gold crowns is also dicey, because the crowns of royalty were always gold, not silver. Now, my best stab at what is happening is that two crowns will be constructed using different materials, a silver one for Joshua the high priest and a gold one, but who is supposed to receive it, since there is no reference to another person? Another mystery is, what prompted this delegation to bring gold and silver and gold to make crowns? Now, perhaps it is that this delegation brought silver and gold as a general offering to help support the temple without knowing that both would be used for crown making. However, I think this is the less likely solution. And again, the context seems to lean heavily towards them bringing those precious metals for the specific purpose of crown making. I mean, why would God, or any human, want Joshua the high priest to have a crown? A crown is totally misplaced in the realm of priests. The law of Moses doesn't call for it. And so far as history tells us, no Levite high priest had ever worn a crown. Kings and queens, royalty, wore crowns, not priests. Now, since God speaks through Zechariah using the most complex symbolism in all of prophetic scripture, then we must be cautious about necessarily believing that Joshua would actually receive and wear a crown. See, these crowns are symbols of a couple of things. In Zechariah's era, it really is a matter of how they're perceiving it. The crowns speak, really, of two leaders of Yehud, Zerubbabel and Joshua, and God's approval of them. Zerubbabel is the secular civil government leader. Joshua is the religious leader. Now, in the context of the times, there was uncertainty among the people and between Zerubbabel and Joshua if they were legitimate choices to rule over the people of Yehud. The presentation of crowns symbolically validates Joshua as God's choice, as well as God giving Joshua additional duties, including judging the people, something that a high priest never before held such authority. But because this prophecy of the crowns applies to Zechariah's time, as well as to a fulfillment at a far later time, we see that this has something to do not only with Zechariah's era concerning Joshua and Zerubbabel, but also later on. It will involve this Zemach character. And while there are elements of what Joshua stands for as high priest in the mission and position of the coming Tzemach, at the same time, the Tzemach's going to sit on a throne and rule in splendor. Now, clearly, this is describing a man who combines both things, a priest and a king. Not just any priest, the high priest, and not just any king, but a descendant of King David. Now, Zechariah could not have imagined who this Tzemach could be, nor when he might appear. But as believers, we know who he is. He is Yeshua of Nazareth, son of Yahweh. And history shows us that this Tzemach will actually make two appearances. And this prophecy of Zechariah is speaking only of his second appearance, or as we understand it, his return. Now, the precedent for a single figure that is both high priest and a king has been set even before Abraham's day in the person of Melchizedek, that mysterious priest-king that lived near the Dead Sea, which Abraham had an encounter with, Genesis 14, 18 through 10, through 20. Melchizedek, king of Shalem, brought out bread and wine. He was Cohen, he was priest of El Elyon. So he blessed him with these words: "Blessed be Avram by El Elyon, maker of heaven and earth." And he blessed, and blessed be El Elyon, who handed your enemies over to you. Avram gave him a tenth of everything. Now, the book of Hebrews helps to make this connection between the Tzemach and the Messiah Yeshua and Melchizedek. And Hebrews 5, starting at verse 1, "For every Kohen HaGadol," every high priest, "taken from among men, is appointed to act on people's behalf with regard to things concerning God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins, and he can deal gently with the ignorant and with those who go astray, since he too is subject to weakness. Also, because of this weakness, he has to offer sacrifices for his own sins, as well as those of the people. And no one takes this honor upon himself. Rather, he is called by God, just as Aaron was. So neither did the Messiah glorify himself to become high priest. Rather, it was the one who said to him, 'You are my son. Today I have become your father.' Also, as he says in another place, 'You are Cohen, you are priest forever, to be compared with Melchizedek.'" So where does the anonymous writer of Hebrews get this idea? From attaching Yeshua and his role as high priest, which he did not hold before he was crucified and later then ascended to heaven, with the very ancient Melchizedek. Well, it came from a prophetic psalm written by David 1,000 years before the book of Hebrews was penned. In Psalm 110, starting at verse 1, a psalm of David, Yahweh says to my Lord, "Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. Yahweh will send your powerful scepter out of Zion so that you will rule over your enemies around you. And on the day your forces mobilize, your people willingly offer themselves in holy splendors from the womb of the dawn. The dew of your youth is yours. Yahweh has sworn it. He will never retract. You are a priest forever to be compared with Melchizedek. The Lord is at your right hand. He will shatter kings on the day of his anger. He will pass judgment among the nations, filling it with dead bodies. He will shatter heads throughout an extensive territory. He will drink from a stream as he goes on his way. And therefore, he will hold his head high. Now, just be aware that what I quoted you is from the Complete Jewish Bible version. However, as I've done in other cases, whenever the word Adonai appears in the passage, I have added back in Yehovah's name to replace it, provided it appears that way in the original Hebrew. So notice how the Father, Yehovah, is the one who anoints his son as the high priest. Also notice how in the fifth verse that suddenly, instead of Yehovah's name appearing, it shifts. And it does indeed say, Adonai, Lord. So by doing this, the psalmist adds a second character to the prophecy. And it is also here that the psalmist, David, explains that this second character, called the Lord, will sit at the Father's right hand. And it is the Lord that will pass judgment among the nations, shatter heads, and drink from a stream as he goes his way doing those things. See, when we put these pieces of Zechariah chapter 6, Hebrews chapter 5, and Psalm 110 together, they fit like a custom-made glove. We get such a more complete picture of Messiah Yeshua in the role he will take on as he prepares to return in the end times from sitting at the Father's right hand in heaven, and then as he arrives back on earth and wreaks deadly havoc on this planet. And we could just as easily substitute the word Zemach for the Lord in Psalm 110 and probably be correct in doing so. So as history has unfolded, as God's plan has slowly revealed itself more and more, we learn that Zemach, the Messiah, Yeshua of Nazareth, the Son of God, and the one who sits on the throne of the millennial temple, who is in the mold of Melchizedek, are all describing the same person. Well, back in Zechariah 6, this is cryptically hinted at with the high priest Joshua being given a crown. And yet, there is another crown made that is going to be worn by an unnamed person. Now, together, Zechariah 6:13 says the figures bearing crowns will occupy the throne in the temple that the Zemach will build for Yehovah, and together they will rule in harmony. And while I imagine Zechariah and those hearing his prophecy assumed, as anyone would have, that this has to be two separate people, a king and a high priest, it turns out that it was but their roles that would work in harmony, with both roles held by the same person. We have the benefit of centuries of history and revelation before us to help us get a far clearer picture if only we'll turn to God's Word and study it. But of course, there is still much mystery about all that is to come that is yet to be revealed, but it will be revealed in its time. Back now to Zechariah verse 13. There has been much debate among Bible scholars just what it means that these two figures, the one on the throne and the high priest that stands before him, will have a council of peace between them. Or as the Complete Jewish Bible says, accept each other's advice in complete harmony. See, the key Hebrew word we find here is shalom. And when we understand that peace is just one aspect of the meaning of shalom, it more means divinely provided well-being, a wholesome completeness, then I think we can better understand it. It means that the civil authority and right to rule that a king holds will be in perfect accord with the terms of the covenant of the law that the high priest represents and enforces. That is actually the way all the kings of Israel were supposed to have operated, but they didn't. They were supposed to use the Torah as their guide to rule and provide justice, but they didn't. Yeshua, however, will. Now, verse 14, as in the complete Jewish Bible and most other English translations, says this: the other crowns will be for Helem, Toviah, Yeriah, and Chen, the son of Zephaniah. Then they are to be kept as a memorial in the temple of Yehovah. I again took out Adonai at the end of the verse and reinserted Yehovah, which is the original Hebrew. But at the beginning of this verse, there is an error repeated by many Bible versions when it says the other crowns, plural. This is not correct. Rather, it is crown, singular. In fact, it is the crown. So we have one crown given to Joshua, and now the other crown's disposition is being dealt with. So this is the second one. This second one is the crown of royalty versus the crown of the priesthood. Now, a group of four men are introduced, or maybe reintroduced. It's confusing to who they might be, because we see the repeat of some of the names who brought the gold and silver for the crowns, but some of the other names are changed. We really don't know if it's the same people for sure, but my best guess is that it is the same people, and over time something happened in editing or copying that got the names mixed up. We'll just leave it a mystery, because there's no way to prove whatever point of view one might have about it. In the end, it really doesn't matter. The point being made is that the second crown is turned over to them, and they're charged with seeing to it that this crown is used as a memorial in Yehovah's temple. Now, the Hebrew word sometimes translated as memorial, at other times as remembering, is zichron. And it includes the nuance of something is being used as a sign to remember something important by. What's the sign of a crown being placed in the temple supposed to mean? It is that the covenant from God that King David will be Israel's king forever has not been forgotten by Yehovah, and it will come about. This thought brings great hope to the Judeans and all Israelites, who will never feel quite right about whoever rules over them until that person is an actual royal descendant of David and that person is a king. See, that outcome is promised in many prophecies and is concerning their current circumstances. Zerubbabel is himself of David's royal line, but he's not a king. He is a governor appointed by the Persians to rule over their province, Yehud, the former Judah. Well, the final verse of this chapter reads this way: those who are now far away will come and help rebuild the temple of Yehovah. Then you will know that it is Yehovah Zebaot who sent me to you. And it will all come about, provided you heed carefully what Yehovah your God says. Who are the far away? Not clear. It might be the exiled Judeans, or it could refer to groups of people who don't worship the God of Israel, Gentiles. However, I think it's more likely that this is speaking of the Jewish diaspora, as well as the scattered of the 10 lost tribes, because they will recognize the name of Yehovah. That is, who but those who know who Yehovah is would know that they're being summoned to come home and take up their ancient worship practices that revolved around the temple? But here's the thing. This cannot be speaking of Zerubbabel's temple. This is only speaking of the millennial temple. So verse 15 is totally about the future. And it is speaking of the scattered of Israel coming back home to join in the joy of rebuilding the temple. Well, in the final words of this verse, one can hear the echo of the calling of God to his people that we first find in the Torah, in Deuteronomy 28:1. If you listen closely to what Yehovah your God says, observing and obeying all of his mitzvot, all of his commands, which I'm giving you today, Yehovah your God will raise you high above all the nations of the earth. When God comes to us, his worshipers, with wonderful promises, they are conditional and always based on covenant. The one possible exception I can think of is the covenant God made with Noah that seems to have no obligation upon Noah except that which Noah already did: build the ark in obedience to God's command. But no ark, no covenant. Conditional. Now, I'm sad to say that the Constantinian Church has for centuries attempted to separate the idea of a promise from a covenant, essentially creating an official and formal instrument of divine biblical proclamation called a promise that doesn't actually exist. That is, it is said to be a wholly different instrument from a covenant. It is then said that a promise is a one-way street in which God obligates himself, but the other party has no obligations, while in a covenant, both sides have obligations. This is simply not so. Just as in Deuteronomy 28, the final verse of Zechariah 6 is indeed a promise that the far away, the dispersed of Israel, will come and help build the millennial temple that Zamok will initiate, provided they heed what God tells them. The word provided is a word meaning something has conditions. But what that promise is also part of is a covenant, the covenant of Moses, the covenant Israel violated that caused God to react against them and to exile them from their land. Let's move on to chapter 7. So open your Bibles to Zechariah chapter 7. We're going to read it all. In the fourth year of King Dariavish, on the fourth day of the ninth month, Kislev, a message from Adonai came to Zechariah. He sent Sar-Etzer and Regem-Melech with his men to Beit-El in order to ask Adonai's favor, as they inquired of the Kohanim, that's the priests, of the house of Adonai Zevaot and the prophets, should we go into mourning and abstain from pleasure during the fifth month, as we have been doing for all these years? It was then that this message came to me from Adonai Zevaot: speak to all the people of the land and to the Kohanim, and tell them, when you fasted and mourned in the fifth and seventh months throughout these 70 years, were you really fasting for me? Was it for me? Rather, when you eat and drink, it's just to please yourselves, isn't it? Isn't this just what Adonai proclaimed through the earlier prophets when Jerusalem was inhabited and prosperous, as were the cities around her, and the Negev and the Shephelah were inhabited? Then this message from Adonai came to Zechariah again. In the past, Adonai Zevaot said, administer true justice. Let everyone show mercy and compassion to his brother. Don't oppress widows, orphans, foreigners, or poor people. Don't plot evil against each other. But they wouldn't listen. They stubbornly turned their shoulders away and stopped up their ears so that they wouldn't have to hear it. Yes, they made their hearts hard as a diamond so that they wouldn't hear the Torah and the messages that Adonai Zevaot had sent by his spirit through the earlier prophets. This is why great anger came from Adonai Zevaot, and it came about that just as they hadn't listened when he called, so Adonai Zevaot said, I won't listen when they call. But with the power of a whirlwind, I will disperse them among all the nations which they've not known. Thus the land was left desolate after them, so that no one came or went. They had turned a pleasant land into a desert. This entire chapter revolves around God's answer to a question brought before him. It occurs in the fourth year of the reign of the Persian king Darius. But by the reckoning of the Hebrew calendar, it occurred during the fourth day of the ninth month, which is Kislev. Still, in the 6th century BC, there was no such thing as a universal calendar that called out years. Years were always based upon whatever your king, whoever your king was at that time, how long he had been serving. This is called a regnal calendar. So every society with their own king had a different perspective of what year they were in. On the other hand, even though we see this date to open chapter 7 is based on how long Darius had been king, it then reverts to the standard Hebrew way of counting days and months that had been in existence in Israel for a very long time. Now, because we are able to mathematically go backwards in time and equate such dates with the common Roman calendar that's in use today, then we can with accuracy know that using modern terms, this is speaking of the equivalent of December 7th, 518 BC. This is helpful to know because it means that it has been 2 years since Zechariah pronounced his first prophecy in the wintertime of 520 BC, which also coincides with when Haggai gave his final prophecy. And this also means that chapter 7 and probably 8 speak of a time before the temple was fully rebuilt and the dedication ceremony occurred. I want to say that again. As we read chapter 7 and discuss it, realize that this is reverting to a time before Zerubbabel had completed the temple. It was still a work in progress and put it back into operation. So verse 2 tells us that Bethel sent Sar-Ezer and Regem-Melech and his men, an entourage, to Jerusalem. The purpose was, it says, to entreat the favor of Yahweh. Now, to do that, it was necessary to speak with Yahweh's priests and his prophets. In that era and from millennia before and after, even though various people groups had various gods and god systems, still there was a common understanding of how they worked. Gods lived in temples. Gods had human servants to see to their needs. These servants were usually divided into various groups, ranging from those who did the most menial tasks, like chopping and gathering wood for the altar fires, all the way up to serving that god directly and being his or her spokesman. This upper echelon group was called priests, and every society's god systems had priests. And each god system also had prophets, who were usually diviners and seers. Israel's prophets were quite different in their purpose and roles from all the typical god systems of the world. because the Bible prophets were all about revealing a direct communication from Yahweh to a king or to a set apart people. But also sometimes it rather obliquely was a message to the Gentile world in general, or even to a Gentile nation in particular. And in truth, we find that at times the prophetic roles and the duty of bringing God's oracles to the Israelite people kind of overlapped between priest and prophet. Now, this new oracle of chapter 7 is addressed to Zechariah 2 full years before the temple rebuilding project was completed. The main focus is on a delegation called Bethel. Now, Bethel had by now a lengthy history in Israel's past, and much of it was divisive and idolatrous, a very important city in the northern portion of Israel, that portion being a wholly separate kingdom since about the late 900s BC and called Ephraim. Bethel was the center of the religious cult that the first king of that northern kingdom, Jeroboam, had instituted. Let's take just a moment to recall how all that came about and why. It's recorded for us in 1 Kings. In 1 Kings 12, beginning at verse 25. Then Jeroboam, built up Shechem in the hills of Ephraim and lived there. And after that, he left and built up Penuel. Nevertheless, Jeroboam said to himself, "Now the rulership will return to the house of David. For if these people continue going up to offer sacrifices in the house of Adonai in Jerusalem, their hearts will turn back to their Lord." Rehoboam, king of Judah, "then they'll kill me and return to Rechavim, king of Judah." Well, after seeking advice, the king made 2 calves of gold. And he said to the people, "You've been going up to Jerusalem long enough. Here are your gods, Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt." And he placed one of them in Bethel and the other in Dan. Located about 12 miles north of Jerusalem, Bethel, in Hebrew meaning the house of the god El, was located in what had traditionally been the territory of Benjamin. Now, although that northern kingdom called Ephraim had been conquered and emptied of Israelites some 200 years before Zechariah's day, nonetheless, not every last Israelite was exiled. A few remained. Now, in Zechariah's era, Bethel was part of the Yehud province, although it was close to its northernmost border. So it fell under the governance of Zerubbabel. Now that said, many who lived there probably felt as much or more loyalties to Samaria, which had been the capital of Ephraim, Israel. So Bethel was a city of mixed allegiances. Now this fellow who came with the delegation from Bethel, Sarazer, was no doubt a person of special standing in the community. The other person mentioned by name, Regem-Melech, also held a high standing in the Jewish community of Bethel. There have been many theories set forth about the identities of these two men, but nothing conclusive enough has emerged to even venture a guess worthy of discussion. Nor can we know whether these were former exiles that had returned or were families that had never been deported. What is plain enough is their allegiance was to Jerusalem. That they came with truly a matter of historic and religious importance to them is self-evident in the fact that such a delegation was sent in the first place. The Hebrew words of why they came are le'alot et panim, meaning literally to mollify the face. Obviously, this was a known expression, but it occurs some 16 times in the Old Testament. So to translate this, as does the complete Jewish Bible, as ask Adonai's favor or in a number of other versions as entreat the Lord's favor, we have to see it as an expression, not get hung up on its individual words. Now, to seek favor here is a term of extra high respect, a humbling of oneself that amounts to asking to be given an audience. And while they may seem to be asking this of God, in reality, they're asking to speak to God's priests, since these men have no means to ask God directly. Now, one of the most important things that this kind of flies right by us is that they accept the authority of the Jerusalem priesthood and of Yahweh. And sometimes it's hard for us to recognize, since we are so far away in both time and place from when and where this happened. But what this tells us is that the authority of the temple apparatus was well accepted, way beyond the boundaries of the Jerusalem precinct, even as far as the outermost points of Yehud's border. This also means by default that the other cities in Yehud, probably nearly all, accepted the authority of the temple and the Jerusalem priesthood. Thus, the Bethel delegation has indeed been received with favor, such that they will meet, were met rather, by the highest authority in Jerusalem in order to address their concern. Now we see in verse 3 that this delegation submitted to the authority of both priests and prophets, acknowledging that both had the ability to discern God's will. This is yet another example of how much both the civil and religious government structure of Judah had changed since the exile. Prior to the exile, the only authority this delegation would have sought was that of the priests, because prophets had very little to do with the temple. What else is instructional to know is this. While prophets produced produced answers to complex questions that were nuanced and it always involved a fair amount of dialogue, the sorts of questions brought before priests were almost always of the yes or no variety. This is because of the main tool that priests used to discern God's will, the Urim and Thummim. These objects were not magical. They were kept in a special pouch worn by the high priest, and in whatever ritual way they were used, they were only able to give binary responses, not complex explanations. So at the end of verse 3, their urgent inquiry is set forth. And it's this: should I weep in the fifth month, restricting myself as I have done all these years? Well, on the one hand, a priest could only answer this yes or no. But a prophet could elaborate. First, however, what exactly is being asked here? See, from a 30,000-foot view, this is a matter of significant political importance. Should the Jewish people of Bethel continue in a mourning practice now the Judeans have returned home and the temple rebuilding process is progressing nicely, the priesthood is back in operation, even though Judah is not politically independent, but rather it's under the control of Gentiles, Persia. Now, because of the relationship between the large walled cities like Bethel and the smaller cities and towns nearby, Bethel was speaking for more than just itself. The question of should I weep is not meant to be confined only to the person asking the question, the I. Rather, it is as a representative member of a community, so it applies to everyone in the community. And clearly, this is not meant as spontaneous crying, but rather weeping, as in a ceremonial action taken on by the entire public. This is public mourning. This is further confirmed with the addition of the public also entering a period of abstaining from pleasurable things. This is a biblical way of saying fasting. Weeping and fasting are standard Middle Eastern mourning traditions. But what was this mourning about that had gone on for so long in the fifth month of the Hebrew calendar year? Well, 2 Kings 25, starting in verse 8. In the fifth month, on the seventh day of the month, which was also the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babel, Nebuzaradan, the commander of the guard and an officer of the king of Babel, entered Jerusalem. And he burned down the house of Adonai, the royal palace, all the houses in Jerusalem, every notable person's house he burned to the ground. The whole army of the Kasdim, the Babylonians, who were with the commander of the guard, broke down the walls of Jerusalem on every side. Nebuzaradan, the commander of the guard, then deported the remaining population of the city, the deserters who had defected to the king of Babel and the rest of the common people. Now, since we know this question was asked in 518 BC, this indicates that this public mourning ceremony had gone on for nearly 70 years. In fact, this also meant that they were less than a year away from the next annual mourning ceremony. And since God made it clear that the Jews were to be exiled and punished for 70 years, does this mean that it's now time to stop mourning and acknowledge instead that that period of exile and punishment had run its course? That is what is meant by the statement of all these years. So from their mindset, it's not as much a matter of can they finally stop this mourning, but rather should they? That is, it isn't that they are saying they're tired of it. Can we finally stop this now? This is an issue of obedience. And to their minds, pleasing God. Jehovah answers this inquiry in verse 5. It begins with, "Speak to all the people of the land and to the Kohanim, to the priests." Now, while the delegation is from Bethel, and it represents that city plus a number of others surrounding it, God says his response is to all the people of the land, and also to the priesthood in general. This is a way of saying everybody, because it's common to speak of the citizens of Israel as being divided into and consisting of two groups, the priests and the common people. The inclusive nature of what he has to say so struck Bible translators that many say we ought to translate the word Eretz in this verse not as land, but as earth. That is, God is saying that his response is for the entire world. My view is that since this oracle, as most do, has a more than one-time fulfillment meaning, and it is typical that the second or even third times that it is fulfilled, the scope of it expands. I think the ambiguous nature of Eretz here initially means the local land, the Judean people, but I think its final fulfillment in the end times, now it's referring to all the people of the earth. God's answer is, of course, profound. It goes far deeper than what was expected. In fact, we're going to look at it as though it was speaking to us in our time, about our behavior, about our circumstances, because it is. And we'll close here and jump into that next time.
For more teachings of real Bible study and to rediscover God's Word with Tom Bradford, visit Torah Class today on the web, streaming TV, or download the Torah Class mobile app.